Why are all the campus protests so one-sided? Does free speech have to mean unrestrained anti-Semitism? Was Claudine Gay the tip of the iceberg on plagiarism? And will all this stuff, plus financial problems, lead colleges to go out of business? Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Conversations, where today we will ask the question, is higher ed going off the rails? As always, I'm joined by my colleague, Philip Magnus, who is a senior fellow here at the Independent Institute and the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
And for today's special focus on higher education, we have invited an expert on the subject, Richard Vedder. Richard Vedder is, of course, a senior fellow here and also a distinguished professor of economics at Ohio University, author of too many things to enumerate, I think, Dr. Vedder. And more especially recently, the author of a book published by the Independent Institute called Restoring the Promise, Higher Education in America, which touches on the subject as he has touched on the subject in many ways before. So I'm delighted to have both of you here. Let's begin with the question of these protests. I mean, what's it all about? And why are these protests so incredibly one-sided? What do you think?
Well, I can start us off. I think the protests have become a proxy argument for an ideological viewpoint in higher education. They're using the war in Gaza as the immediate occasion. But what you hear when you go to look at some of the rhetoric that's coming out of campus sit-ins and occupation movements, it's basically Marxist post-colonial theory, arguing that this is a mechanism to tear down the West, to tear down capitalism, and usher in the fantasy of a socialist revolution that several of the speakers at these events seem to have deluded themselves into wanting. So they're very much on the left wing. You see hammers and sickles all over the place at them, in addition to other symbolism that is associated with the far left. But they're, using a current cause for something that they would agitate for in any other circumstance around other causes. And you know, this is a tradition that goes back to Karl Marx himself. He was an activist in search of a revolution that he could latch himself onto and claim as the fulfillment of his own ideas. So here we are almost two centuries later, they're basically doing the same thing.
I agree with Phil completely. And if you'll go further, the distinguished journalist John Fund pointed something out to me a couple days ago. There's quite a bit of empirical evidence the intensity of the protests is the greatest in the academic aristocracy enclaves, Harvard, the Ivies, Columbia, yeah. My alma mater, Northwestern University, and a number of other schools. The ordinary state university, where I'm sitting right now, Ohio University and others like that, maybe 50 students showed up for a 30-minute or an hour protest one day. They went home. That's the extent of it. It has not been the same. It's interesting. It's the rich who are leading the revolution. The Marxist revolution is being led not by the proletariat, but by the exact opposite of the proletariat, the very people that Marx himself protested against. Are leading this crazy revolution of this inane revolution that's going on in the universities today.
It's fascinating, Phil, that you said you used the word proxy, because putatively, the subject of these protests is somehow the Israeli invasion of Gaza, which is a response to the attacks from Gaza into Israel. Putatively, that's the point. But as you say, what a hammer and sickle got to do with that?
Exactly.
It's a proxy, which is just fascinating to me. But it's not just that there's campus protests. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 1970s campus protests. Rich also may be old enough to remember those. But at that time, certainly there was left-wing protests, anti-war and whatnot. But there was also, I mean, I was there. There were the SDS, but there was also the Young Americans for Freedom. Even more one-sided. I don't understand exactly why that is.
Well, so what Rich was saying, I actually saw a chart, someone had quantified this, They showed that the universities that had these occupation tent cities setting up on the quad, they had the smallest percentage of Pell Grants. So they're basically rich people sending their kids there. Very low federal aid, and they tend to be elite Northeastern private schools in the Ivy League and Ivy League adjacent. So it's clear as day that these are not representatives of the proletarians. They're like cosplaying as proletarian revolutionaries, but these are children of privilege that are studying under professors of privilege and the absolute elite. You know, the comment I always make is, if your only tool is a hammer and sickle, everything looks like a revolution. And that's how these people are basically operating. It could be Gaza. It could be some other war. It could be a completely unrelated cause, but they shoehorn it into this Marxian worldview of oppressor versus oppressed. And that defines who the good and the bad guys are. They've designated the Palestinians as the good guys, the Israelis as the bad guys. And everything is a colonial oppression regime that is being justly resisted in the minds of these protesters. So they'll cheer and justify and legitimize everything up to and including extreme violence, because it's righteous violence in the name of the revolutionary cause. And then they have this fuzzy notion that somehow this is going to trigger what topples capitalism, or what topples the injustices in the world and causes other people to rise up. And they don't get it. They get angry when average normal human beings that are just trying to go about their everyday life, including their fellow students who are just trying to go to class, just trying to graduate, look at them and they're like, well, who are these crazy people? We don't want them disrupting our campus life. So they rage when the general public looks at them and sees, yes, they are indeed a very fringe cause.
So for purposes of the cosplay, what's going on is that Israel is cast in the role, as it were, of the rich capitalist white oppressor, and the Palestinians are cast in the role of the downtrodden proletariat.
Exactly.
But then, as is characteristic, not just now, but of kind of historic Marxist-Leninism, Marx and Lenin recognized that the proletariat was probably not, you know, likely to rise up on its own. It needed the vanguard.
Yeah, so they're the self-appointed vanguards.
The vanguard of the proletariat, exactly. So the vanguard is comprised of people who are smart enough and probably rich enough to have the leisure to play with all this stuff ideologically. But they themselves, of course, are motivated by a kind of weird self-hatred, because they stand on the, you know, the wealth produced by this remarkable free wealth-generating society. They're enjoying that, but there's a kind of self-hatred. And so it's that self-hatred which I think animates these protests in a weird way.
Yeah.
Rich, you were trying to say something. I'm sorry.
Well, several things. This is a fascinating conversation. One thing about the historic nature, as a historian of sorts, I like to look at historical processes. I was not only young enough, I was anti-war during the Vietnam War. On cost-benefit grounds. It just didn't seem to me like a war worth fighting for the national security benefits that the United States might receive. And it turned out, of course, I was spectacularly correct in that assessment. There is that thing. I'll tell a real quick story. I was teaching class one day, and a student burst into my room. This is circa 1970. And the student said, "Class is dismissed. America has bombed Cambodia." And I turned to the kid and said, "Get the hell out of here. I'm teaching this class. You are not." I don't know if that's relevant to anything, but it does point out protests have been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
But statistical evidence is that American universities have become more and more left-wing enclaves.
Yeah.
They always were to some extent. But if you look at the statistics on what percentage of faculty vote Democrat or Republican or whatever, however you want to measure it, the statistics show that that has changed rather strikingly in favor of a leftist orientation in the last generation. And it is more prevalent in the Ivies, in the elite schools, than in the Slippery Rock State University or the University of Last Resort in Alaska or wherever you might
That's a fallback school.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say at this point. Like Phil, us professors, you know, tell me how many minutes you want us to talk, we'll talk. But I'll let Graham, well, this is your party. I'll let you ask the question.
Fine. Well, one thing that I think is worth kind of segueing toward is that it seems that there is a kind of related dynamic between this remarkably lopsided, ideologically lopsided protest movement and what we see going on intellectually at the universities. And you mentioned that there's such a left-wing tilt. That's certainly been documented, and it's true. But I sense that there's more than just a political tilt going on. I think that there's some kind of an idea that it doesn't really matter to be objective and dispassionate and even-handed any longer, because nobody believes in objectivity and facts, but they just think that everything is a power push. And if everything is a power push, then all these protests are fine. And not only that, but there are apparently, and Phil's the expert on this, but there are apparently leading academics who think that if everything's a power push, then they don't have to be careful about footnoting and they can plagiarize other people and so forth. Am I onto something here? I'm just wading into a mess here, Phil, but what do you think?
I think it's absolutely the case. There is a decline in rigor in the academy in what gets put forth as scholarship today versus even a generation or two ago when there were strongly enforced norms that you don't fabricate data, you don't plagiarize, you don't cheat, you don't misrepresent facts. These were seen as major scholarly sins. And if you committed them, not only could your article or your book be retracted, it was seen as a very negative mark on your career. It could be career-ending to be caught with plagiarism. Today, if your politics are on the right side of
the
academic...
the left side.
Which is the left side. Yeah. Yeah, anything to the right of Stalin is seen as the bad guys in some of these viewpoints. Because the academy has moved very sharply to the left. But I think there's a more serious issue here. There are no longer internal checks on misconduct and unrigorous studies. Because if you only have an echo chamber that's doing the peer review of your article, they all think the same way. They see their political views reaffirmed and confirmed, and they'll put through, honestly, what is published in many major mainstream journals today is worthless dreck. It's political nonsense. It's activist rambling that looks like a Unabomber manifesto rather than a scholarly paper just to confirm and support a political point. And people are getting promoted and given tenure on non-rigorous dreck because it supports a certain political viewpoint and affirms a position that the academy views itself as the guardian of.
Yeah, in some ways, it reminds me of Nazi Germany or the old Soviet Union. There is a ideological monopoly that controls things, and if you are not part of that monopoly, you're out of here. The Enlightenment is coming to an end. I mean, what was the Enlightenment? The Enlightenment of the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s that brought about, among other things, the Industrial Revolution, the rise of democracy, the rise of little places like the United States of America. All of that is now being pushed aside, and we're going back to an earlier world, a strange world, where there's one view, it's my way or the highway, and then whether it be the Catholic Church in the 1400s or communism in the 2000s, the Stalinist era, we're moving to that in the United States, in the universities. But fortunately, there's enough of the public who doesn't agree with that, that the universities are now in trouble, and they should be in trouble. I actually think the troubles that the universities are having are great. It was about time that the universities be forced to pay some price for their inanities. Sorry.
the link back to the protests in my mind is that if these kind of people who regard the academic enterprise as being essentially a power push, And don't feel obliged to standards of objectivity. If these are the ones who are educating students, then the students are going to absorb these ideas, because that's, you know, students absorb their teachers, basically. And they're absorbing this idea that everything is just a power push, and therefore they go out and do a power push without reference to facts. I mean, it's stunning. You see these interviews of these campus protesters and whatnot. They scarcely know the facts about the things that they're protesting about.
That's exactly it. They can't even string a coherent sentence together about what the Gaza-Israel conflict is about. They couldn't explain the dynamics of the war, the underlying politics, other than it's the oppressor versus the oppressed. So you get two types of answers when these interviewers are going around at the protests. One of them is just a complete oblivious idiot who is standing there because they agree with the revolutionary cause, but they cannot articulate anything about it. Or the other is the person up there in the microphone spouting like critical theory and Marxist talking points that they're trying to shoehorn into this political event. So neither of these are based in fact or reality. It's really the politics have been put ahead of any form of analytical understanding of a very complex event. And I say this as someone who's skeptical of wars in general. I think the Israel-Palestine conflict is something that has multiple dimensions that need to be explored in a scholarly way, and they're basically the antithesis of that. They already think they have the answer without even analyzing it.
Mm-hmm. I was on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania back in the 1990s for about 8 years, and I saw the evolution of thinking had already been well underway, obviously, but it was pretty stunning to me the ways in which my faculty colleagues were really increasingly cavalier about objectivity and beginning to adopt this idea that, you know, oh, well, insistence on objectivity is a right-wing thing. We're left-wing, so why should we go by their standards? It was beginning even then pretty powerfully. And I wonder, though, Phil and Rich, you both can comment on this. Is this phenomenon of the abandonment of sense of objectivity in scholarship simply a matter of the humanities, or is it also afflicting the sciences?
Well, I suspect, you know, I am not perhaps an expert on this, but you're seeing more and more absolute fraudulent work in the so-called sciences, where we are having papers withdrawn, where people are making up data and so forth. I would point out that that has always been something of an issue. I like to tell the story in 1990 or 1995, I would run 100 regressions to make a point, and 99 would agree with the position that I think was right, but one would take the contrary position, and so there would be some ideologues who want the other position, and they would say, hey, one of the 100 regressions I ran show that taxes have absolutely no impact at all on economic growth. And 99 out of 100 would say it does. So we always, even in the old days, sort of picked and choose the results that we wanted to push. There was a tendency that, but people tried to be, most economists and most scholars, why I said economists, I don't know, that was a slip, yeah, I know, but it would apply in most academic disciplines. I think we have become much less serious about things and much more ideological, as both you and Phil have been saying over time.
So Phil, what's your take on this question of whether the hard sciences are also afflicted by this stuff?
So absolutely. The hard sciences, I view as something of a trailing indicator. The politicization started in the humanities, and they seem to be, like, if you look at English and philosophy and history and some of these other departments that are in representative of the humanities, they're like 80 or 90% of the faculty are on the left. But what's going on here is the humanities, even though they're in free fall in the terms of the number of majors that they're attracting, nobody wants to take these classes under their own volition. They are overrepresented on the general education curriculum, the mandatory classes that you have to take in order to graduate. So that's where the politicization started. students are basically forced to be the butts and seats in the English classroom, where instead of learning about literature and writing, they're being read Marxism and climate change activism by English professors no expertise in economics, no expertise in climate science, no expertise in the policy devices that affect either, but they do have strong political opinions about it. And that does filter over into the remainder of the university. The other thing you have, humanities professors are overrepresented in faculty governance and faculty administration. Two reasons for this.
They have more time.
They have the lowest opportunity cost on their time, so they can serve on every single committee and do activism in terms of that. And the second thing is, because of the job glut in the humanities, there are too many PhDs produced, not enough jobs. What are they doing? They jump over into the administration side, and suddenly, instead of professor of English, they're dean of student services or assistant vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion. You look at these people, they all have humanities degrees in deeply politicized disciplines, and then they can enforce ideological conformity on the rest of the university from the top down. Now the STEM fields suddenly get a diversity officer attached to their hiring committees, and they have to do a diversity statement in order to hire someone, which just becomes an ideological litmus test. So it's grown out of the humanities because they became so politicized, and now it's spilling over into these other disciplines.
You mentioned climate science, which I think is an interesting case in point. I'm a French, unfortunately, many of us aware of some of the background here, where there were many climatologists who were pushed away from, discouraged from expressing any doubts about the anthropogenic climate science, whatever, global warming theory. But if you express doubts, then you weren't with the program or with the cause, and there was research was suppressed. It's kind of stunning. The whole climate science area is a remarkable case in point. That isn't to say that I know the right answer on all the climate science questions, but I'm deeply troubled by scientists, so-called hard scientists, talking about, you know, being with the cause.
Right.
That's just, being with the cause is, it's not part of being an objective scientist or an objective scholar of any kind, right? Right, Rich?
Yeah, and it there are other areas similar to that. For example, during the whole pandemic episode, there were a number of very interesting and prominent scientists who were skeptical of the sort of what became quickly the prevailing wisdom of the government bureaucrats and some people that, well, we got to shut down the nation in order to save our lives. We need to close the schools. We need to not only wear masks and get vaccinated, but we need to essentially isolate ourselves from other people. And this became very big and very very prominent. And although ironically, there's some places in the world like Sweden who didn't do that, and everything was fine in Sweden. It was just like, you know, like the virus or like the flu, you know. Some kids got sick. Big deal. That happens. That's part of life. And we had that in the United, but in the United States, there are people, I think of people at Stanford and so forth, the Great Barrington Statement, where you had some courageous scientists who were saying, hey, let's not jump on this bandwagon too much. And they were ostracized and they were vilified and they suffered. And so it's a very serious problem, and it goes beyond all disciplines.
So what we've done, interestingly, in this conversation so far, we've traced a kind of thread that goes really from the protests, but actually then back to the ideological lopsidedness of the faculty. But that, in turn, goes back to a more deep and pervasive issue of the nature of reasoning, the nature of evidence and scholarship. And so there's kind of a problem here. But I would say, it does seem to me that there may be a few signs of hope. Some of the signs of hope may be economic reality, which we'll get to in a minute with Dr. Vetter. But another sign is, I noticed that MIT recently decided that they would stop requiring faculty applicants to give a DEI personal testimony. You know, why I love DEI ideology used to be a required essay. But MIT has decided, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea. Is that a sign of hope, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only that, the Washington Post ran an editorial against mandatory DEI statements. This is a very left of center paper that had been on board with this ideological movement for a while. I think what we're seeing there is that some of the most nonsensical elements of the DEI movement, the most heavily politicized ideological components of it, have peaked. And now there's a skepticism in the general public, as well as a skepticism internally to universities. What you're finding at places like MIT is they probably notice that these are being used internally, not to say that diversity is a good thing, which is, you know, they play language games here. We can all agree we like diversity, but what they really mean is a very particular concept of diversity that aligns with critical theory, that adopts all of these normative Marxian priors and brings them into how we specify and apply diversity, equity, and inclusion. So that's the reality of these things. But they're seeing that they were used as ideological litmus tests to disqualify
right.
the best applicants, disqualify people that otherwise would
be
strong candidates in terms of merit, and elevate only candidates that have political agreement with the diversity bureaucrats and some of the administrative nonsense that's going on there. So a retreat from that is at least a good sign that they're headed back in a meritocratic direction.
Interestingly, looking back on my own experience, when I was denied tenure at the University of Pennsylvania in a pretty fraught ideological battle, I was told afterwards by the department chairman that if I had had the right gender and the right race, they might have tenured me anyway in spite of my views. But the fact that my views and my race and my gender were all considered relevant was symptomatic of the problem, even back then. So turning to Rich Vedder as an economist of higher education in particular, it would seem to me that the big institutions, Rich, seem to be able to get away with whatever they want. But what about the rest of higher ed? I mean, surely there must be some kind of economic consequences for all these crazy things that are going on in higher ed. What do you see in the higher ed economic landscape?
Well, you're right, exactly. But the higher ed community has always been protected from market forces. Perhaps a better way to put it, market forces have not been able to exercise their power and their positive dimensions effectively, because governments have bailed out failing institutions, failing strategies, and have permitted all of this to happen. In part, universities are wards of the state. They are effectively governed by the states. The states fund them. The states fund, provide the universities provide the intellectual firepower for the politicians. They even provide a little bit of the contributions that the politicians use. There is some direct transfer of money from the universities to the left in politically. All of this is going on, and so therein lies the problem. And so the universities that are rich, the Harvards and so forth, that have $50 billion endowments, $2-3 million of endowed money for every student, $100,000 in income coming in from investments, these schools are just utterly unresponsive to the market forces in general. Although, admittedly, if endowments take a big tumble, the universities notice it. And and indeed, one thing about this protest, why the universities are starting to show a little bit of sign of renewed sanity, just a limited amount. But part of it is that when you get big donors dropping, saying we're no longer going to give $100 million a year or our $1 billion endowment gifts, when that starts happening, the colleges start to think, oh, maybe this is going to hurt us. So that they're starting to respond. That's been one of the positive effects of all of this protest movement.
Well, you know, what I've noticed, though, Rich, is that certainly the big boys are going to, you know, survive. They've got billions of dollars tucked away. But what actually happens also is that the middle tier and lower tier colleges essentially ape their bigger brothers. They take their cues from the elites. And so they adopt all the same craziness, but they don't have billion-dollar endowments. What's going to happen to them?
And so some of them are going to die, as they should. I've been arguing for some time. In fact, I remember being in a conversation with Phil last year we had, and you were there too, Greg. You were the impresario of this little party we had. Somewhere, where were we? Monterey, California.
We were in the Monterey Peninsula, yes.
Mm-hmm. We were in the Monterey Peninsula talking about all of this, and I blurted out, you know, that what higher ed needs is a little creative destruction, which was a term that Joseph Schumpeter used back in 1942 in a book called Capitalism, Socialism, Democracy. And that's the way the business sector operates. The companies that make mistakes fail. They go out of business.
But Rich, that's not nice, Rich. That's not nice.
That's not nice. Where is Enron today? Enron is gone. What's happened to Eastman Kodak? Remember Eastman Kodak?
Oh, very well.
It still exists. For that matter, what has happened even to U.S. Steel? It still exists and it's emerging, but it's a shadow of its former self. It's nothing compared with it was 100 years ago when it was the world's, America's largest corporation. So this is what, the markets are marvelous in this. And markets, however, are sort of kept out of higher ed or have been. And so a lot of schools are going to die in the next year or two, and I am rooting for their death. I will attend their funeral if asked. I'd be glad, or Victor, I think in a sense, for the last several years, I've been writing obituaries for the Independent Institute on Higher Ed.
Right.
And I've written them with some gusto and some fondness, because higher ed should die. Not all of it.
No, not all of it.
Not all of it. It does many good things. But 10% of it should die, or 20% of it. Well, 10% of American universities would be 300 universities dying a year. That wouldn't kill higher ed. Higher ed would still be around, but it would send a message. And we need to send more of these messages.
You know,
and
here,
we're starting to.
Here's an example. Here in Northern California, there was a historic and previously remarkable women's college called Mills College here in Oakland.
Mills.
And I think about 7 years ago, my daughter and I, who was trying to figure out her college plans, we toured the campus, and she was just stunned and repulsed because although it was a women's college, everywhere she turned, there were sort of gender-bending things of one kind or another. The admissions process pivoted on playing out all the different gender categories. She was clearly going to be an outsider in that context, and not only that, but there was a very, besides the, you know, the gender thing, there was a kind of anti-capitalist mentality. So Mills College now no longer exists as such. It went out of business. It was purchased, I think, by Northeastern in Boston, oddly enough. So they have a tiny institute program there. But there's this historic and beautiful campus. It looked like some of the best upper Midwest, you know, historic liberal arts colleges. And it was. But then it decided that it had to ape the big boys and go left, but it didn't have the same resources, and so it ran itself into the ground, which is really tragic.
It happened Antioch College in the Midwest, which 100 years ago or 50 years ago was considered a fairly high-quality liberal arts school. It's happened to many, many schools that are starting to die off. And I think that should be sending a lesson, and it is to some extent, but it's been a muted lesson. It hasn't been had the force that it would if we didn't have all these subsidies, including federal subsidies. We haven't even mentioned we haven't even mentioned the federal government in all this.
Right.
The federal government, as bad as state and local governments are, federal governments are worse because they're so far from the people and so far from the action. Phil is sitting near the center of all sin in the world in Washington, D.C. But for those of us who are farther away, including Graham and myself, the Department of Education has contributed to this, and the student loan policies have contributed to this. It's a sad situation.
Yeah. Yeah, the growth of tuition seems to have been inadvertently, or maybe advertently, fueled by the growth in federal support of one kind or another.
Absolutely. Bill Bennett, in 1987, he was then Secretary of Education, a respected scholar, had a PhD, has written books. Some of them have become quite bestsellers, and so on. Bill Bennett wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, of all places, where he said, you know, it occurs to me that this growth in federal student loan programs and the federal aid programs will cause tuitions to go up because the universities will see that, oh, the parents can go out and borrow the money. We could just raise fees aggressively. And before then, fees were going up just a little more than the overall inflation rate. After then, they started rising much, much more rapidly. And so higher ed became much more expensive. And ironically, a smaller percentage of recent college grads are from the lower quarter of the income distribution than was true 50 years ago. The great goal is we're going to educate the masses. We're going to help the poor. We're going to help the disadvantaged, those who don't have access. The efforts to right that problem have actually boomeranged because of the law of unintended consequences.
Which is a law that economists are very good at. They understand that. But of us ordinary people, we just have trouble. We think, we want to help, those with lower incomes, so let's give lots of student financial aid and so forth. But then it didn't turn out that way. And then of course, that forces federal leaders like President Biden to decide, let's selectively forgive all sorts of federal student loans, which happens to coincide with his political interests, but it also exacerbates the problem with higher education and its financial basis.
Exactly. And to me, the craziest part about it, I don't think it's helped President Biden politically at all. I think he completely misread that. He completely misread that issue, completely, because for every college graduate whose loans are forgiven, there are several other people, including other college students who paid off their loan, but even more importantly, people who never went to college, who never were able to get a special subsidy from the government. Why should we subsidize a kid from a middle-class background who wants to go to a college when we don't subsidize the high school kid who barely graduated from high school, wants to open an automobile body shop, or wants to open a coffee shop or something? Why do we not subsidize those people, but subsidize these college kids? Why are we doing this?
Hey, that's... Rich, I have the answer. Subsidize everyone for anything that anybody wants to do.
That's the end game of the socialism.
Exactly. Yeah,
but there's an interesting point here. It may explain why it's backfiring. Here you have Biden going on TV, saying we should forgive student loan debt, forgive student loans. And then on the next channel over is the crazy person waving the hammer and sickle in the tent encampment on Columbia's lawn. And you're the average voter is going to look at that and say, wait a minute, why am I forgiving student loans for this person who's not even going to class? They're sitting in a tent protesting something that is of very low relevance to them that they can't even coherently explain. And yet they're wanting forgiveness for a $100,000 a year tuition payment. It just doesn't add up, and it violates all.
Yeah, and they're mouthing they're mouthing vile anti-Semitic slogans, and they want to get their student loans forgiven.
Yeah.
So it's kind of stunning. So a minute ago, Rich, you bandied about a number like 20%. How many colleges do you think are circling the drain financially?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. There's even some doubt, by the way, about how many colleges are there.
Right.
You count junior colleges, two-year programs as colleges, or are they just sort of an extension of a high school? You know, where do you draw the line? What's a college? What is it? There are a lot of certificated programs that are actually booming right now because they offer a person that you say, come and study with us for 6 months or a year. We'll train you in some vocation, maybe to be a computer coder, maybe to be a welder, and welders make $7,500 a year. They don't have student loan debt. They can get into the market after years of training, maybe, and be making good money. And so we'll give you a certificate that says you know how to weld, and that isn't a degree at all. And those programs are doing pretty well, and they should be doing well. Whereas the gender studies major at the College of Last Resort can't get a job anywhere. By the way, Columbia University graduates in things like gender studies. I'll use Columbia since it's rather well known these days. Go out after finishing college, usually the median income of them are in the $25,000
range. It's basically a useless degree.
A useless degree, Ivy League schools. And then at less than Ivy League school, I don't know maybe should move to Ethiopia where they can make more money. It's crazy.
Well, so the answer to my question is, probably quite a few are circling the drain, but it's hard to nail it down.
Yeah, it's measured in the hundreds. A decade ago, it was measured in 10 schools a year would die, or 20 schools a year would die. And Clay Christensen, who wrote a lot on this a decade ago, predicted that half the schools would die, or that it would be measured in the hundreds and thousands.
Wow.
Was proved wrong.
Yeah, right. That was too much.
Because of the bailouts of various kinds. But now that now the public is getting a little unhappy about the bailouts, and the bailouts are declining, and state politicians are now jumping into the fray and saying, we're not going to give you money unless you do X, Y, and Z, and which is a good sign that the outside is getting more and more skeptical.
Like the public was willing to tolerate some degree of the political left-wing nonsense if the university was providing other services, other things of value. But now when it has moved so far to the left and that's like the only thing coming out of campus, well, the taxpayers in some states are going to turn off the spigot.
Yeah, the only thing that colleges are doing well these days in the eyes of the public is football and basketball, which in most places in the world, it's not even considered a university activity. I mean, the playing with balls, it's crazy.
I think I saw recently, or maybe last year, Rich, am I right that Forbes puts out a grading scale of the financial stability of American colleges and universities? And I'm looking through the, A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever, the most financially precarious were F, obviously. But there was a stunning number of ones ranked D, which were very, very, and even some of them, like my favorites, so to speak. I thought, oh, wow.
No. Yes, there are a lot of schools that are really on the brink, and they could go either way. And if the political complexion of the nation is such that we're not going to support colleges more as we have been in the past, or bail them out as we have in the past, I could see hundreds of colleges failing in the next decade.
If I were a college leader of a college that was financially precarious like that, I would look around at the landscape and I would probably conclude that the best strategy would actually be to reverse course and create, renew an institution that actually was committed to academic integrity, rigor, non-political studies, meet a market or a demand for what's not being supplied by the rest of the higher education community. That seems to me like it could be a
winning strategy.
Formula for success. It could be a winning strategy, yeah. Don't go with the crowd, and then you'll draw a different crowd, and then they'll be willing to buy your product.
Recognizing that currently large swaths of the student population are not being served by this crazy political nonsense
right.
that the Ivy League is putting out.
Right. And not just the Ivy, it's the Ivy League and then the sub-Ivy League and all the imitators of the Ivy League. All the wannabes. Yeah, exactly. Okay, this is pretty interesting. So we're going to be watching this territory, Rich Vedder, and see what happens to these colleges. And I would just mention, if I could tantalize our viewers, that one should pay attention, stay tuned to Rich Vedder, because he may be doing some more interesting commentary on the subject of colleges' financial stability and instability in the nearish future. So I'll just put that little tidbit out there.
Oh. That sounds fascinating.
I
was looking forward to seeing. That's a nice way to put it, Grant.
Thank you for
There are more to come.
From Richard Vedder on that subject. Thank you for the work you've done on that. Phil Bangus, thank you for the work that you've been doing.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Trying to pry the lid open of the Pandora's box of higher education. You've made a big difference in a lot of these issues, for example, in helping to document the lack of academic integrity in the plagiarism of Claudine Gay and others. There may be more to come on that subject, too. Again, thank you for all the work you've done on those subjects yourself, Phil Magnus, and I'm looking forward to talking to both of you further on the subject of American higher education and other matters in the future. And I encourage our friends who join us for this conversation today to make use of the resources we provide for you at the Independent Institute website, which is independent.org. We publish a lot of rigorous, well-documented studies, as well as books that are worth reading. We're here to educate people on the facts. We don't believe in spin. We believe in evidence. So join us through our website and other resources. And then join us again on our next episode of Independent Conversations. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.